This is the beginning of Channel One Over on First Day's Tape. Channel One Over, the First Day's Tape, Tuck Mac, on Thursday the 19th of March, 1970. This is Channel One Over. Channel One Over on the First Tape. Channel One Over on the First Tape, Thursday, late on Thursday the 19th of March, 1970. Thursday the 19th of March, 1970. Tuck Mac. Channel One Over, the First Day is taping. The First Day is taping. Tuck Mac, Thursday, 19th of March, 1970.
And they can swallow one of them big grains of corn?
Yes. And I'll tell you something else out of them. It's been 3 years ago Robert Denton came out here. We don't plant corn or anything around here anymore except a little for eating, you know. And we used to plant fields there. But he come up here with his son and two more fellas and asked me if he can go back in there and shoot quail. You can go back in there and hunt. But I doubt if you find any. Anyway, they went on back and they came out and they had seven, I believe. And he had one man that he said he could make a quail answer as far as he could hear him. And he was out there talking and he heard one whistle down there and he whistled back at him and the quail answered. Boy, took the dog and went down there and found him and killed him. But what I was going to tell you, I learned these quail crawl were just as full as they could be. And I got the feeling in there, these things been eating corn. And I said, where'd they get it? That was the next thing popped in my mind. And finally I got so curious, I told one of them to crawl open. You know, it was just a little thin skin that held it. And it was acorns. And these white oak acorns and scrub live oak acorns, they're small. Oh, when you get it hulled out, it's not but about half as large as my fingernail. And they had hulled those things and they swallowed the inside of it. And I asked Robert, I said, you know anything about these? First I ever seen them. It was my first. Now, these old ducks that's Winky Pin was telling you about, they can swallow those, and they're larger than a live oak acorn, like.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they're hard as a rock, wouldn't they? You could take one and put it on some and take a hammer to crack it.
Yeah.
And it's got a little old green thing inside there. I don't know what you'd call it. You can eat the other, and they're good green, but if you eat too many of them, it's like taking purgative medicine.
Yeah.
But don't eat that green. It's just as bitter as gold. You have to be particular how you eat them. But if we were talking about the horses, they had some, you might say, wild cattle up here, too. We first moved down into Hamlin. The old man, Barr, his son-in-law was a bank, and the old man was well, I reckon he's in the real estate business and everything else, had orange groves, and his grandson was the one that was living out here in the Hamlet. Well, the old man had bought a bunch of cattle and never paid any attention to them, and they just about went wild. Then when the grandson come along, he'd go out and buy gentle cattle and put in there to try to tame the wild ones up, and the outcome was the darn gentleman's just went wild. So they finally decided to kill him out.
Oh.
And at that time, Micanopy had two beef markets. And it handled from 2 to 5 beeves a week.
Yeah.
Now, it don't seem like that's possible, but meat was cheap then, and people could eat a lot of it.
Yeah.
And we'd go out there and shoot those things down and had a block and tackle. We'd get to a tree with a limb on it and put it up and butcher them out there and kid and come to town. Later on, we got a truck and car and thing. You get out. And after you did that certain length of time, you had to be quick on the trigger to get one. I had an old gray horse. He wasn't a fast horse. But I'd catch him out on the prairie, and I'd pick me out one, and I'd run out there and either cut him out or get side of him and shoot him. And a lot of times, I'd just be so close I'd hold a rifle barrel right down like that over the, close to the horse's ear. And he got so, we'd done it so much, he got so when that rifle shot and that stiff dropped, or cow, whatever I killed, the race was over for him. He stopped right then and there. He had gone for it. And I did that so much he got deaf.
Yeah.
couldn't hear.
Yeah.
And but before he got deaf, we used dogs a lot for hogs and cows. And those dogs started running, and I don't know whether he could or not, but it seemed like it to me. When they bayed, whatever it was, seemed like he could tell it. Well, if you started him towards that dog, you had to hold back on him. He was going, and he'd run right up there and stop. And you could do whatever you please. But we pinned a few of those cattle and branded some of them. We never did gentle them up.
You know, after I didn't get down in Florida until everything pretty well tamed down, you know. But I still see a lot of these wood cows and some of these old Bremers.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted some of them, some of that stock. But I always afraid to get them. My old fences wasn't in account, you know. And I had that old corral there that Miss Bruce Boyles built, or Tommy Mitchell
mm-hmm.
built it out of that old lumber form. And it wasn't too strong. I didn't have a place to handle them. I always wanted some of them.
Yeah.
Never got them. But I have noticed this. Every now and then, even with this dental stuff I have, I get a cow that's mean,
yeah.
or wild, or what would you say?
Hard to handle.
You know, put the ears up and strikes out. And you know what they'll do? One cow like that, when you're trying to handle a bunch of them, will get in there and weave in and out of them other cows and get them all excited where you can't handle any of them.
I know that.
Yeah. Well, now that I can go from that to what you had to put up with out there.
Well, in my opinion, there's two types of those Bremer cattle. You can take one out in the open, the foreman for Norris Cattle Company. He came up here one time and was talking, and they had a lot of Bremer down there. Well, they had them gentle. They had them in open pasture where they could see them every day.
Yeah.
He said the way to get along with a Bremer is to go out every morning and speak to them and speak to them gentle.
Yeah.
And he said, don't raise your voice. There. Well, it's not only Bremer, it's Jerseys or Angus or anything else.
Yeah.
If you get him excited or mad, best thing to do is back off and let him cool down and you cool down and then work him gentle.
Yeah.
I learned when I first took this hammock over up here, they had a man up there and he was a good man, but he wasn't a cattleman. You'd have from 10 to 15 riders out there that probably herd up 100 or 150 head of cattle. And he had some of boy didn't know which end of the horse to put the bridle on.
Yeah.
So he didn't make success of it. Well, then they got let him go, and they got a boy by the name of Man Daly. His daddy's, well, he is too now. He was one of the best cattlemen that I've ever known of. He just knew how. So this man, he came up here and took over. And I was running my cows up at the time, too. We'd go out there with four or five men, three or four dogs, and we put the cattle in the pen because he knew how. And they had not purebred Bremers, but a lot of mixed. Half and two-thirds and like that. And I learned a lot from him because he'd go out there and we'd get them herded up and he'd just let the dogs circle around. We'd sit there probably for an hour. Just maybe move a little bit every once in a while. Then one get ahead and start off and we'd be on the side and in the back. We'd start those Bremers off and we never had a whole lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But God Almighty, when Mr. Rain was up there, sometimes some boys would do the wrong thing, they'd stampede. Each one had him a different route to go.
Yeah.
You couldn't do nothing with them.
Yeah.
They bought three Bremer bulls in Texas and had them shipped out here. And they were nice bulls, but I don't know whether they ever was drove or handled or what, but put them up here in this hammock and they got to where they didn't want to drive. So Mr. Wren decided he didn't want no more Brahma. Well, I had an Angus bull. I think he'd got the best calves of any bull I've ever owned. Well, I used him 3 years, and then he was going to start inbreeding, you know, and I decided I'd get rid of him. And I asked Mr. Wren about trading, if he wanted to trade. He said, I'll give you one of them Brahma bulls for him. I was okay. Well, I guess it must have been right about the time we was going to trade. Anyway, he told me, he says, if I could cut those bulls, if I could put them in the pen, he was going to chain them to open pasture. And one day I was up there feeding hogs or fooling around or something, and when the cow was in heat, all three of these bulls would take after. And I just might fool them things to the pen. And I got behind, didn't try to drive them, I just followed them. And that old cow, she headed for the pen. And the bulls followed, so I got them on over there and got them in the pen, and I called him. I told him I had the bulls in the pen. He says, I don't believe it. I said, you want me to turn them out? He said, no, I'll be up there. And he come up, and must have been long then with the time of trade. He got two and left one up there. I used him 2 or 3 years. And I believe that they'll do better in the wintertime than Angus or Herefords or anything, because they'll eat sticks and leaves, and I reckon they're more in the order of deer or moose or something. But this boy Bailey, he sent me 150 head of mixed Brahmas up here, help us bred. And he did it in the fall, and I always thought that was a mistake, to move cattle in the fall. Move them in the spring and let them get kind of acclimatized for the next winter.
Yeah.
Well, they got along fine, and they were beautiful cattle, average 800 pounds or more. And they started calving, and we had one of these oil-fired, bad, wet winters. And they just went
like
all.
Like this?
Yeah. Just went all to pieces, and he lost quite a few cows and calves, and we fed over 600 bags of feed.
Yeah.
And so finally he told me one day, he says, I'm going to move those cows. I said, well, Wade, how are you going to move them? You going to drive them to Ocala, Oxford, or where? And he says, what do you mean? I said, you can't get a truck back at the pen to haul them out.
Oh.
And so he went over here to Zetra's and made a arrangement to carry him over to, we got a fish prairie back over here too.
Yeah.
And he had a pen over there on high ground. And we drove those cows out and drove them around there. And he loaded them and hauled them away.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the last time he's had anything to do with them. I can do it all now.
That's right. You've got to be careful when you're going out here a season like this.
Sir. The only way we get up and I was in a Jeep or a tractor. But normally when it's dry, you can ride all over pretty near in the car.
Yeah.
And Clyde Bailey gave Mr. Rainey a San Gertrudis calf, a yearling. He brought him up here, and he grew up large enough service, and always wanted him. And so when Mr. Rainey started to leave, I said, will you sell me that bull? He said, do you want him? I said, yeah. He got up to 1,400 or 1,600 pounds then, and I sure do want him, but I can't pay no fancy price. He said, how about market price? I said, yeah, I'll take him for that. Well, it rocked on, and they got kind of confused with it swapping around, and he left, and I didn't know where I stood then. The proposition I had, I was to look after the, keep up the fences, look after the stock, and I got all the farmland I could use free of rent, and run my cows in there, no pasture in. And I saw Bailey about it, and he said, ask me what proposition Randy made me onto. That sounds all right to me, you just stay up there. And I said, well, I want that Santa Gertrudis bull, and I said, I made arrangements with Randy to buy him at market price. He says, that sounds all right to me. Well, the next time I got him in the pen, I said, man, let's get this bull business straight. I want to pay for them or do something. And she's got him up here, ain't she? I said, we'll keep him. And I don't know how old you reckon he was when he got killed. 10 years old?
I don't know. You had him along?
Anyhow, we went up there Monday. On a Monday. I had a feed place at a gate going into a field. And he was just as gentle as a dog.
Yeah.
He'd come up and eat out the jeep or the car, whatever you had to feed in. And there was an old, big old ash tree. The top had blown out of it. And I guess it was Monday or Tuesday, the storm come, and that thing come down and hit him right across his neck and killed him. Well, I didn't find him till Wednesday. Of course, he was falling. I couldn't use him. But I sure did hate that.
Did that happen often?
No, that's the first time.
A limb or anything hit a cow?
We've had to see a old cow dropped hip, you know, or something, and we just always figured a limb or something. Hit her.
Yeah.
Knocked her hip down, and I'd always heard that ever since I've been large enough to fool with cattle, about cattle getting tied up by the tail. In all my experience, we'd never had it, and I'd hear different cowmen, you know, talk about I had a cow tied by the tail or something. And well, during dipping, we didn't have very many cattle, and we were fortunate enough. We only had two out. One had a calf. I found her, but the calf was too little and too young to come to the pen. We had a dipping vet right up there. And our dipping day was on Monday, which forced us to get up cattle on Sunday. And I had two or three old dogs, and I would go over there at 3 or 4 o'clock Sunday evening, bunch them up and drive them on and put them in the pen. And I couldn't find that steer. Well, there was a fella working in the hammock up there, he was fencing it, and all that back there then was open range, and a good one. And just as we got through dipping, he rode up there and said, "Tuck, you know, got a steer out?" I said, "Yes, I know it." And I said, "I hunted him all over the place." And he told me, "He's over yonder on a branch, tied up by his tail." They get in there and get to switching it flies, and a little old bush about that big, and somehow or another they get that tail whipped around and that hair ties it, and he stays there. And boy, I went over there and cut that sucker loose, and I told the inspector, I said, "I'm going to get him," and I said, "I'll bring him back here. If you didn't have him up there and they had to come back or something, they made a little charge against you, you know. And if a range rider had to go get him, I went over and cut that hail on that steer. Boy, I had to ride fast to keep up with him from that house. He come home.
Let me tell you, I never even heard of a cow getting tied up with a tail before.
Well, it's a fact now. I know it, but I have seen hail around a bush.
Yeah.
And they probably didn't get tied up where they jerked loose. But this steer, I don't know if he just stayed there and he starved to death or not, but he was there and he was tired.
Yeah, probably would if he couldn't get loose.
Well, now you see, when you got him out in the country like you've had over here, that's a little different from
in
from,
the fields, open pasture.
That's a whole lot of difference. There's not much to happen to them.
That's right.
Now over there where I am, you got that prairie, you see, but it's all hard bottom.
Yeah.
They can't even mire up down there, you see.
We used to have a lot of trouble with that. The cows getting in the bog, they'd get thin, you know, and go out in the prairie. Which, we've got it's a muck, I reckon. And then, beneath that, most of the bottom is clay.
Yeah.
Well, if they get out there and get stuck in that, they're just there.
Yeah. Well, now, over there, they get down to they go through a little muck, down to a hard clay. Well, wait a minute, it wouldn't be clay, would it be limestone?
No, it's what we call a hard pan. It's
You can dig in it.
Well, I know. You can dig in this hard pan too, but it don't dig like sand.
It's way out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard. I'll put a fence across one point in this Ledwith Lake. Before I was married, it's 1.875 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And the lake was practically dry then. And, well, we hauled all our material out there with mules and wagons, wire and posts. had brace boards. And that's been at least 50 years ago. And you know, the majority of those posts are there now.
Yeah.
And the brace board is made out of cypress.
Yeah.
But what I was going to tell you, we dug all those holes with post hole diggers. Well, you get through that muck, then you get in clay. Well, you had to have a post or something. It'd stick to your diggers, you know. You'd have to take it out and knock it on that to get the clay off where you dig some more.
I
didn't know it till here 3 or 4 years ago. Mr. Zetrow fenced off his portion of the lake, and he got these treated posts. And I don't think he put them in the ground too deep even. But he'd sharpened a wedge in one end of it.
Oh.
And he had a ring that went on the top.
Yeah.
Of some of them. Of course, the ring wouldn't fit all of them. He'd start that down, and the nigga would work it back and forth, and that thing went right on down in there.
Oh, really?
And he must have put up, guessing, about 4 or 5 miles of fence up there.
Yeah.
But the lake was halfway full then, and he hauled all that material from the edge out there with a frog boat. This boy, Horace Birch, had making up his run across.
Yeah.
He hauled most of it out there with his old frog boat.
Yeah. He still have it?
Yeah, but I don't think it's running now. His son-in-law's both, oh, there's a half a dozen of them around there got frog boats now, airboats.
Yeah. They come over here?
No, that man won't let them go in. They go on, they have been going on Ledworth Lake, Levy Lake. But since Whitehurst got it and cutting those ditches, I don't know whether they can navigate over there now or not. I imagine they can go some places, probably over on Ramsey's side.
Well, they, why do they all go at night?
In those frog boats, they're hunting frogs.
Well, don't they hunt anything but frogs?
Yeah, some of them do.
Yeah, so I see.
They can catch a duck.
Yeah. They don't want to go out and just fish.
No. Any other sorry thing to fish in, I would try. If you've got the least little bit of wind, you better have some big anchors.
Because
the wind will blow, you see that motor sticking up there, and then that man in the front, he sits up on a high seat. Well, the wind will just blow you, and if you got anchors, it's just rocking back and forth.
Yeah.
The only thing I know they're good for is to get from one place to another quick.
Yeah.
You can really get this fellow from Gainesville, Gus Cox, of the Cox Furniture Company. He had one out there with a real large engine in it. And we've been out there and started across the lake, and he could run over ducks and blue peas.
Yeah.
Just before they could get up, he'd unpass them and go. And he used it to fish in, but I never did like it. I want me a good
fish. Now, you've been out with him?
Yeah.
But you don't care for it?
No, sir. I don't care for no airboat. Robert Dent and me went over there on Tuscarilla one time. It was practically dry. Well, we went in on the west side. He's got some land that borders on the lake. And he said, let's go over to Billy's side. I said, we'll catch some fish over there. Well, half the time we wasn't on water, we just run on flags. And he got over there and we caught a few fish and come up a little shallow rain. And I never heard as many frogs in my life. They were great big prairie green, and those boys went in there and just cleaned them out. They couldn't do much as long as they, and what they raised on out there, and there was a lot of flags out there, not so much hyacinth then.
Yeah.
And when the lake filled up, well, naturally they come to the clay and the edge, and they went out there, and Robert Denton, he was driving a beer truck at the time, but he'd drive that truck and hunt at night, and they made money at it.
Mm-hmm.
This neighbor boy of mine up here, he hunts a little bit. He goes out, well, the frogs are a whole lot smaller now than they were. And you catch 20, 30 pounds, down a half a pound. That ain't bad. But this is work. You go out there and shine that light, and he used a little kicker.
Yeah.
And he goes out there at dark, and he stays out there right near daylight.
Yeah.
And it's hard work. in a little old tiny boat. I don't see how he stands. Of course, I used to do a lot of that stuff too, and hunting the alligators. That was a sport and hard work.
He don't get too much for his time, does he?
No.
If he used to get 20, 30 pounds at night.
Well, if he gets 30 pounds, that's $45.
But he got to pay for his boat.
No, he owns his own boat. You know, the little three-horse kickers. I'll bet you say he can run all night. See, he doesn't run fast. He goes slow. And he can run all night on 2.5 or 3 gallons of gasoline.
Well, what does he do? Just ride up there to the frog and take
shine it with a light and take a little gig and jug him.
The light, when you shine the light, see that blinds them and they don't move.
And they don't move.
Scare them.
So, I used to hunt alligators. And
just up that close to them and you can't miss it with a little gig.
And you can miss them, but he don't miss very many, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And back 15 years ago, more, I reckon, this boy and me hunted together. He didn't use no gig, and we didn't have a kicker. He'd go out there, and I'd push a boat. He'd just get out in the front and catch him with his hand.
Yeah.
Just shine a light on the blind, reach up and grab him.
It's been longer than 15 years. It's more 25.
We was over on Benny Franklin's, back of Benny Franklin's farm. We got over a little for a night. We had us a 2 tarpaulins, we'd put one down and stretch the other one over and had us a skeeter net. And we'd go out there and cook supper and put up our bed, we call it, a tent, going and hunting. And we'd give out, we'd come in and get on that thing and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And I never saw any more frogs in the little place than there was that night. We caught 3 feed sacks full, and I got so tired, I told him I had enough, and I went and got in the bed. Some little old ponds around there, and he'd get some bullfrogs and things of that long. It wouldn't take but a very few of them to make a pound, but you know, we didn't get near the price from now that they're getting now.
When you caught alligators, you get small ones?
Yeah, the real small ones. Now you could sell real small ones, but from what we call babies up to 4 feet, there wasn't no sale for them. You could sell a 4-foot one.
Oh.
A 7-foot one brought $4.40, and it dropped $1 each foot. A 6-foot, $3.40, 5-foot, $1 less, and then a 4-foot. And we started hunting like that at first. And then Jacksonville Alligator Farm, they would buy the babies, and we'd catch all the babies we could, and 50 cents a piece. That was money back then, too.
Yeah,
and then this boy's uncle and first cousin, they come in. Well, they started nest hunting. Go and find an old alligator nest and rob it, bring eggs home and put them in a place and hatch them out.
Oh.
Well, we started that, and we wouldn't kill the old alligator. Well, she, you know, she'd have a cave right close somewhere than that. We'd leave her, and it's sort of like it. Saying by killing a goose that laid a golden egg, we leave her there to reproduce.
Sure.
And these other boys, my gosh, they started getting eggs, killing the old one and all.
Yeah.
Well, we decided if they was going to do it, well, we was going to do it. And in just a short time, the gears got awful scared. And a lot of people just, well, we did it, you might say, for a livelihood for a while.
Now that's the end of the second side of the cassette. That's the end of the second side of the cassette. And now here's a part side.
I had to have a cow drive. Well, say if I had cattle, my neighbors, 3 or 4 of my neighbors would come and help me. And when they decided to drive, I'd go help them. And pretty near every old farmer, he'd have my dog or two. They'd get out there, the woods was open. And most all of them had old long cow whips. And it was something to see a crowd of men going through the woods with a whole bunch of cows, dogs barking, and they were popping those old whips and hollering cow holler. I never was much of a holler, but some of them could really holler.
Yeah.
And some of those whips would sound like a 12-gauge shotgun when they popped it. And it was, I called it fun, because I was a yelling kid then, you know. And man, I just loved to go on the drive.
Sometime they'd go for time he could see. When he'd get home, it'd be after dark. But they didn't think nothing about it. It was like you said, it was a long day.
Mm-hmm. But ever, it's all exciting.
Yes, sir.
You know right now, over there, all them gentle animals I got, whenever them cows change pasture, they just all so excited.
Yeah.
They get in a hurry. Even them old cows.
Yeah.
And they get in a hurry and they kick up the heels, you see. And twist the head. And the calves just go lickety split. You go on a cattle drive, I've never been on one of them. Now that's something.
Well, it was before my time, but we didn't have any, never thought about anything like an auction sale market.
Yeah.
They'd either drive them to a railroad somewhere and load them in cattle cars. I have known well this old fellow was boss out here in the hammer. And he said Likes used to have cattle drives and would go all through the country and buy cattle, carry them somewhere, bunch them up, and drive them from here to Tampa.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe, isn't it?
That's hard to
believe. But they said they really did it.
Yeah.
And I can remember when there wasn't any, well, there wasn't near as many cattle then either. They didn't have an auction market in Gaines. Lord, they start, and you know it's seldom that they don't sell over 1,000 head of cattle every week up there.
You just wonder where they all come from.
Yeah, right? That's right. And he used to live right up here. You know where the little white house is, and then there's the old house that's back where each of them lives.
Right there, right up here as you turn in the lane.
Our mailbox.
Oh, is that who that is?
Yes, that's Henry's boy, H.M. Everybody calls him Red.
Yeah.
He used to gather watermelons for the Richardson brothers, and in fact, he's done enough hard work to kill two men and drink enough whiskey to kill three.
The boy?
No.
Henry.
He was, he never was a real large man, as you know, but God almighty, that fella could work.
He really worked?
Yes, sir. In the log woods, block woods, build fence, dug wells, anything. And I used to farm and get my crop in, get it laid by, and I'd go out in the woods and saw.
Yes.
And every time I did that, seemed like something would go wrong on the farm or something, and I quit it.
Yes.
Then I got the truck farm fever, and I farmed 3 years with Mr. May, wasn't it? Sharecropping. First year I made a little money.
Well,
next
tell
year.
Him about the Martin, you and Henry was going to get the hog.
Yes.
That's what I want you to tell him about. Uh-huh. That was before Lawrence Robert was born, so that's been
40.
About 48 years ago now.
Yeah.
My daddy had a big old horse, yeah. He's a pretty good horse, but he's pretty lively. And we had a lot of pigs, hogs, shoats up in the hammer. And the boys wanted to catch 6 or 8 or 10 to butcher and give round for Christmas presents. So that morning he had his horse and I got us old horse and we started. We was loping up the road in a hurry to get there. It seemed like early in the morning was the best time to catch them. And you had dogs and bay them up and sometimes you'd catch 2 or 3 out of one bunch. But that morning we was going up the road and all at once this old horse, he just left the road and took off across the woods in a fast lope, I'd say. Well, he got pretty close to a pine tree and I decided I wanted to go back towards the road and I reined him over that way. And he reined till he got right at the tree, then he changed his mind and he went on one side of the tree and I went up against it. Well, it knocked the breath out of him, man. I reckon unconscious, but Henry, he was pretty excitable along there. He said, you hurt? And I said, no, it was something. And he said, do you want a doctor? Well, I was trying to get my breath, and I said, oh, again. And the next thing, when I come to, and I could hear, I could hear his horse's feet. Boy, he was just running hard as he could. He come up here and got my dad-in-law, and they called a doctor. And they got in the car and come on back down. Well, I was up and I looked at my saddle and it had tore it up. Broke both latigo straps off of it. And the old horse had run off. And I got in the car and come home, and the doctor come out here and examined me. He said I just bruised up a little bit. Brother-in-law come that afternoon, and we in here, I went quit hunting. I spit up a little blood, but it didn't amount to nothing. I was sore. And this young man that was boss and his dad, granddaddy owned that place up there. He was there particularly if he kid his daddy anything to eat. Well, it had to be just right. So I don't know how it happened. I wasn't up there. But the butcher did show it's just from 50 pounds to 75 or 100 maybe. And they killed the old doctor one and forgot to open it up. And I said to myself, I thank the Lord I wasn't up there that day. And we used to catch those hogs when they got fattened on egg, and they were just as fat as any fattened on corn or peanuts or anything else.
Yeah.
And we'd make up a whole lot of sausage, and we'd use it out there, and he'd take it to town and give it to his friends and use it. And that's where I learned how to make sausage.
Uh-huh.
Back then, it was more or less guesswork. And all of it was done with a little hand mill,
yeah,
which was a pretty good job. Of course, I always had some help.
Yeah.
And when you went to seeding, it was more or less guesswork. Nowadays, they got the seeding packaged up in little packages. You can weigh your meat,
yeah,
weigh 25 pounds, and put a little pack of that seeding in where you got it seeded. And it takes all the guesswork out of it.
Henry did a little of everything then.
Yeah, he farmed a little bit, and he's a lucky sucker. Farming, he'd go out there and just a little one horse farm.
Yeah.
And I'd use two horses to break my land and all. He'd go up there and sit around, and he wouldn't put in but so much crop. But about four and a half, maybe 5 days out of the week, he'd work, and the rest of the time he'd go fishing, do what he wanted to. And he always, practically always made a good crop.
Yeah.
And he raised a boy and two girls, just like we did. And I've often said, which wasn't far from right, he kind of turned his kids out to pasture.
Yeah.
And we tried to take care of ours. And we always kept a milk cow and had plenty of meat and lard and syrup, eggs, had chicken. He had always had plenty of chicken, but he didn't try to raise and sweet potatoes. Sometimes he'd raise some, and sometimes he wouldn't. And I swear it looked like his kids got along better than ours did.
Yeah.
I have seen that man. He used to work for Hoyt Grimm. You've heard of Hoyt Grimm, Miss Grimm.
Yes, sir. He died, and I never saw him.
Yeah.
Not to know him.
Yeah. Henry was Hoyt's right-hand man. And
I didn't know that.
I told you that when I got my crop laid by, I'd go out in the woods. One morning, they had some timber. Let's see, what was the name of the little old place? Puss Thomas' daddy lived out there. What is the name of that little old station? Anyway, just up at T&J from Southside. And they had a carload of blocks out there. And they asked me if I'd go over and help haul and load them. Well, I was hard up and needed a little bit of money, and I said, yeah. And Hoyt had an old A-model truck with no cab, no windshield on it. And it was cold that morning, sure enough cold. And I went up there and got on that truck with him, and the radiator leaked a little bit. I had all the clothes, I had an old piece of overcoat on. We got to the woods, and where that radiator leaked, his icicle was hanging down from it. First thing I did when I got out there, I got an axe and went and got me some wood and built me a fire. Henry had on a pair of overalls, I don't know what kind of underclothes he had on, and a pair of socks and little old shoes, and one of these old jumper like these pants are made out of. And a hat, and that's all he had on, of course, his shirt. And I said, Henry, ain't you cold? No. He said, let's go to work and get through. I said, I ain't going till I get warm. And I didn't. I just stayed there. I got good and warm. But he could I don't know if a nigger could do any more work than he could.
Well, now, I didn't know that. You see, when I knew Henry, he's didn't have too much vigor.
Yeah.
And he talked like he'd done a lot of work, see, but you can't tell.
Well, after he got, I reckon, old enough to know better, so he got him a little blocking outfit of his own.
Yes.
And he got his boy and Mitchell boy.
Yes.
And a nigger too, and he'd go in the woods and he'd cut timber. He'd get little patches here and yonder.
Yeah.
And he did pretty good.
Yeah.
And then in the summertime, back then, the mill would probably shut down for 6 weeks or 2 months. I mean, 2 months, 6 weeks or a month, or 2 months. And he'd jump out and take his old truck and go and gather watermelons for people.
Henry would?
Yeah. And he'd gather for Mark and Walter and them down there for 7 years. He'd go down there before the melons got ripe and walk through the patch and he'd prune them.
Oh.
And when they got ready to cut, he'd go tell them they was ready to cut and he'd tell them, well, go on and cut them. And he was doing good and he, well, I think he had about quit drinking at that time, but his wife was quite a bit older than he was and he started kind of running around and he got in with a little woman out there and that's what ruined him.
Yeah.
Just, and lost interest in his business and we were practically raised up together.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Where was your home place?
When I was raised up from Fairfield, Old Callum, back to Reddick. And then I left a man come up here and 1917, I reckon, 16.
You've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, whose place is this?
This was her mother and father's.
This is her home place?
Yeah, and I built that little house up there on the road, and where the little doctor lives now.
Oh, yeah.
And when Mr. Chitty died, there was four more girls and a boy, and none of them would want to come here and stay and take care of Mrs. Chitty. So we come and took over the place and they said if we'd take care of her the rest of her life, they'd deed us this place.
Yeah.
And so we come down here and got stuck and we've been here ever since.
1917?
No, not right here.
No.
That's when I first came to Micanopy.
We moved down here in 1938.
That was on Thursday, the 19th of March, 1970.
This is Channel 1 Right. This is Channel 1 Right, 550. And Wednesday, the 2nd of April, 1970. Wednesday, the 2nd of April, 1970. We're coming over here tonight and try it again. The third time, it failed over tonight. We're going to try it again in the big kitchen tonight. Channel 1 Right, 555.
end of Channel 1 over, the end of Channel 1 over, on this first visit to the big kitchen, Tuck, Mac, and Ms. Mac, and this is the end of Channel 1 over, the end of Channel 1 over, and the first part of our visit at the in the big kitchen on April Fool's Day, after supper, after we had tried three times to use my little headquarters over there, and they had let us down every time. And this is the first time we're using the big headquarters. The system way of saying is out of sight, and just talking away, and the talk is so much slower and quieter. And this is the end of Channel 1 over. This is the end of Channel 1 over, the first part of